Hello, I'm Neil Schiff, and welcome to Inside the FBI, a weekly podcast about news, cases, and operations. It's been around 60 years. It's the FBI's 10 Most Wanted Fugitives list. Most people call it the FBI's top 10 list.
Part of the success goes back to it being a direct appeal to the public for assistance. The FBI goes out to the public and says, this is a fugitive that we want to catch. It's a very dangerous or significant fugitive, and we need your help.
That's Special Agent Brad Bryant of the FBI's Criminal Investigative Division. He's the chief of the Violent Crimes Major Offenders Unit at headquarters in Washington, D.C.
That direct appeal, I think, it leads to a lot of good information coming in from the public that leads us to the fugitive lots of times. Of course, the media plays a big part in that. That direct appeal goes through the media. So the media has played a big part in the success of the FBI's Top 10 Most Wanted Fugitive Program. And, of course, just the hard work and perseverance of our case agents. They work very diligently on these cases. They don't give up, and they run out every lead that they're that's generated. And eventually, we usually find the fugitives.
The 94% capture location rate is phenomenal.
It is. It's extremely successful. I think we've had 494 fugitives on the list, and 463 have been apprehended. That equals 94%. We're very proud of that. And again, it goes back to the assistance of the public and the media, as well as the hard work of the agents. I believe about a third of the fugitives on the top 10 list have been captured as a direct result of assistance from the public.
Why was the 10 Most Wanted Fugitives program created in 1950? And what was the beginning with the publicity like?
Well, as you said, it was created in 1950, but it goes back to February of 1949, when a reporter from the International News Service asked the FBI for the names and descriptions of the toughest guys the FBI would like to capture. And the resulting story from that generated so much positive publicity and had so much public appeal that on March 14th of 1950, Director Hoover implemented the Top 10 Most Wanted program, and we've had that program ever since.
Wasn't it one fugitive at a time for 10 days, and then a few of them were caught over a brief period, and they had to add a couple of more?
Yes, that's correct. They added one a day for the first 10 days of the top 10 list, and there were some arrests made that very first week of the top 10 list.
Who was the very first fugitive posted on the FBI's top 10 list?
The first person added to the top 10 list was Thomas James Holden. And he was arrested in Beaverton, Oregon, following a tip from a citizen who read a wire service story in the Portland, Oregon newspaper, The Oregonian, and that citizen contacted the FBI, which led to his arrest.
And that's the reason for the Top 10 program, to get citizens to call in tips and leads so that agents can go out and catch these dangerous fugitives.
Absolutely. It's that direct appeal to the public that makes the Top 10 list such a success.
Jeff Covington is retired now, but he was an FBI special agent when there was a nationwide manhunt for a suspected killer. Andrew Cunanan made it across the country to New Jersey and then headed south to Florida. Covington was working in the FBI's Philadelphia office when the manhunt hit his backyard and the FBI's fugitive task force didn't skip a beat.
Got a call from an agent in Chicago, and he called the task force and wanted to speak to somebody about a guy named Andrew Cunanan. And, of course, you know, I hadn't heard about him, but it turns out that this guy was gay, and he had killed somebody in the Minnesota area, and he had just killed a guy, a rich socialite in Chicago by the name of Lee Miglin. No one's sure how this relationship started, but somehow after Cunanan killed that guy in the Minnesota area, he left and he contacted Miglin in Chicago. Stayed at his home a couple of days, actually killed him. Stole his car, but prior to leaving, he stole a bunch of gold cougar rams. I think those are the some of the coins that they keep that come from South Africa.
Covington says the FBI in Philadelphia learned that there was a phone in the Chicago victim's car. Cunanan was now driving that car, and a tracking system was put into use.
As long as that phone is on, they can track his movements. So he moved across the country. We found out that he was in the New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Philadelphia area, and the techs here were tracking his phone. He was actually on 495 over in New Jersey. And we were setting up to grab him, and all of a sudden the phone signal was lost. We don't know how that happened. We don't know if he heard on the news or somebody called him or there was a leak somewhere that he found out he was being tracked by this phone inside the Lexus, and it got turned off. So at that point, we didn't know exactly where he was.
At some point, it was determined Cannon was in New Jersey. It's believed he killed a cemetery worker and switched cars and headed for Florida. He was trailed to Miami Beach, and the law enforcement, media, and citizen pressure was growing. Cannon eventually took his own life after apparently killing a world-famous fashion designer in Miami Beach. Another manhunt years earlier in 1979 was in Tennessee, outside Memphis. Cecil Moses was the FBI case agent in the hunt for Billy Dean Anderson, who was wanted on a charge of assault to murder. Anderson was on the run for a couple of years, and Moses, now retired, had a hunch that he was living in the mountains. Many leads were followed. A tip guided Moses and other agents into the mountains to Anderson's mother's house. Moses picks it up from there.
You have to understand mountain people to really understand that. But I knew in my own heart and mind that this man would prefer, you know, living in a cave, living in an abandoned coal mine, over being in a prison. And that's why I felt he had not gone to a city, that once he was, you know, on the 10 Most Wanted, had all that glare of the media on him, he immediately came back into the hills and started hiding out and found this cave. And he had notches on a tree that he would show every year. He cut a notch on the tree beside this entrance to this cave, which he kept concealed. But just looking through the file and looking at his background, he even studied to be a minister in the Methodist faith early in his life, kind of similar to my own. And there were just so many parallels to his initial life. You know, he certainly didn't look like initially a violent type person. Grew up, modest situation, and was going to be a minister. In fact, he's buried there behind the Wolf Creek Methodist Church there in Pall Mall. It was just those kind of things sort of put together that I was firmly convinced, in trying to put myself in his shoes, that I would prefer to live a mountain life than to be in some jail or prison. So I had permission from the Bureau as part of the plan to offer $10,000 cash reward. I went to the mother prior to all of this and begged her to, I said, I don't care, just have him surrender. All we want is to have his day in court. I don't care what the outcome is. We've got $10,000 cash. I don't care if you take the money and hire a lawyer. Our job is to bring him in. And she fussed at me and screamed at me and said, you know my son's dead and you're just harassing this old woman. And, of course, I knew, you know, in my own mind that she was lying, and she was. And so the night that we finally had to take Billy's life, she come screaming out there, you know, threw herself across, and I just said, get her out of here. Because I looked her in the eye and sat in her living room, literally begged her to get Billy to surrender. You know, and we would pay the reward, no questions asked, and she lied right to the end. So I felt no real sympathy for her, you know, given the opportunity she had, and refused to cooperate.
Moses says that Billy Dean Anderson was asked to come out of his mother's house by the FBI.
The agent called out to Billy to drop it, you know, FBI. Drop your web. He's carrying a rifle in one hand. He had two guns strapped on his belt. And so instead of dropping it, he wheeled around to try to shoot toward the sound of the agent. And then the agent fired two blasts from a shotgun, a double-aught buck. You know, there's 12 pellets in each round. And he connected with 23 of those pellets. And Billy hit the ground pretty much dead there in the mother's backyard.
Next time, we'll have more about the FBI's top 10 list and apprehensions. Check the internet for additional history. It's at www.fbi.gov. That's our show for this week. Thanks for listening. I'm Neil Schiff of the FBI's Office of Public Affairs.